Jema, I heard some word like newcomer. Yeah, so we are all newcomers because this is a yoga which has never been attempted at this level at least. It has been probably, people have dreamed about it, but it's a new yoga. 100 years is nothing. It's literally next year will be 100 years of this yoga. So it's a new yoga and a yoga which strives to build a new consciousness within us about which the mind has no idea because it is something greater than the mind which is going to do it. So with this background we come to the subject of religion and spirituality. One of the great difficulties which I have seen, Shobindu points out at it in Secret of the Vedas, is that the human mind uses words today in a very fixed manner, relatively fixed manner. But the ancient tongues did not do so. So there was a certain degree of plasticity around the words. So why this is important is because while there are so many dictionaries in the world, but we don't relate to each other based on the dictionary meaning. We relate on the basis of the pictionary which we carry in our head since childhood. So use the word religion to a Hindu, he will have a very different meaning out of it. Use it to a Christian, he'll have a different meaning. A Muslim will have a different meaning, and then one starts wondering, then people fight which religion is true. Because the word religion as it is understood in the English tongue is very different from the way it is understood in let's say Sanatana Dharma. And why I'm saying this is because just maybe a few months back someone sent me an article which was written by a very reputed, respected Aurovillian, where he said that, well, people try to put Sri Aurobindo and Sanatana Dharma as if they were, but actually, you know, Sri Aurobindo said that we have to go beyond religions. So there is, we have to leave behind Sanatana Dharma. This was the gist of the religion, gist of the article, which I found very strange and very funny because anybody who has read Sri Aurobindo and the mother would understand that this is not what he is saying. So one of the problem is that the word carries a different meaning in our heads. And these meanings we have gathered as we have grown up through life. So it's very important to understand that when Mother and Shobindu are saying, what are they really communicating to us? It is an inherent limitation of the words, and that is why both Sri Krishna and Sri Aurobindo use a phrase which is Shabda Brahma Ati Vartate. Go beyond the scripture, written or spoken. So scripture is a help, no doubt about it, one of the four aids. But if we remain only stuck with the scripture and don't try to get that experience which the scripture is meant to embody. Going beyond the scripture doesn't mean we say it's useless. No. There is something which is embodied through the agency of words. And we have to receive that. We have to move towards that. So this is another big problem with words when we use, that we have to go beyond religions. So, you know, we immediately, with religions, we have an idea associated in the mind. And sometime back, for example, even within the ashram, it was felt that, you know, if you are offering a flower, you are being religious. So somebody was asking me, I said, well, you may meditate with the religious consciousness. It's not an activity which you can. Religious is an approach towards the higher life, necessarily a limited approach. That's why man has to transcend it. But it's not like either or. Mind plays out with things as either or. That's why the other day we were reading, when we look at what are the gradations of bhaktas. So Sri Krishna says that there are two kinds of bhaktas which are not yogic but they are accepted. Shobindu also says the same thing. He says there is a arth bhakta who cries in distress to the divine and the divine responds. So he has formed a contact with the divine, and that may become a bridge, who knows, in the future, towards a deeper seeking. And there have been so many instances of people crying to the mother in distress, and then, you know, they got a response, and then they explored, they came. One of the famous stories is of, John Kelly, who, you know, Maggie wrote a book on that, The Light That Shone Into the Dark Abyss. He was in a state of distress, and the lost footsteps, Antonio Silvio Curias, that, you know, there is a distress in which we cry, the divine response. And then we may or may not, but we may develop a greater seeking. Similarly, there is the Artharthi who seeks the divine for worldly and material benefits. And Sri Aurobindo was asked that when we are supposed to go beyond desires, why does the divine grant these earthly things? He says, well, because I suppose at some point he will begin to desire the divine. So, and then of course the higher two kinds of bhaktas are the jigyasu and the jnani. One who is a seeker of knowledge and the other is a knower. So we can look at religion and spirituality either as an either or principle. That's how the mind does it. So mind takes it that there is religion, there is spirituality, you draw a line, this is black, this is white. That's how the mind operates. Mind cannot understand that life moves through several gray zones. And if you just put things in black and white, then it breeds a lot of hypocrisy and it creates a lot of confusion. Because life doesn't fall into two categories. There is the darkness out of which we are rising, asadoma sadgamya, tamasoma jyotirgamyas. So one is either or, the second is to see them as a continuum. And the third is that to see them as conterminous, they coexist. So it is very interesting. In Synthesis of Yoga, when we read about the sacrifice, the ascent of the sacrifice, that is the chapter where Sri Aurobindo says that, well, people have a certain kind of approach. They have a physical symbol where they like to bow down and they offer flowers and things like that. So he says one way to look at it, the exact words, maybe I'll post it there, that one way is that, well, it's religious seeking is in the beginning permitted and allowed until the deity whom you are worshipping outside, you begin to worship, discover inside. So that's one way that, well, because man's eye is not naturally turned within, so he needs a temple, he needs a cathedral, he needs an image, he needs an idol, and through that he turns within, which is one part. But then he says, even when we have discovered the divine within, still the necessity or the usefulness of the outer remains, and that is very interesting. And he says it remains because your outer being also wants to participate in the movement. It's something so beautiful. And many people, this something so simple, so direct, because, you know, after all, people carry in their wallet the photograph of their parents or their friend or whoever. And why do you carry? It's because it adds to that love. It's another gesture of expression of love. So when people say God is all within and you don't need anything external, that means we are depriving the body of its own joy of participating in the inner movement. So when we read, there is a beautiful mother writes that, you know, three expressions of surrender and self-giving to the divine. And she corresponds them to three gestures. And one of them is that bowing down completely, lying prostrate at the feet of the divine. And she says that it's complete self-giving. Now when we see the mother's own story, when she came down, she says something very interesting, that when she met Sri Aurobindo, one of the first things that she did spontaneously, without being into the Indian tradition, without knowing that it should be done and what its meaning is to bow down. And this bowing down, she makes, you know, she speaks about it very in a very rich sense. And this bowing down, Sri Aurobindo, when he looked at this bowing down, of course he doesn't use the word bowing down, but when he was asked by Barinda that what did you see in the mother? Mother has written in her prayer that what she has seen in Sri Aurobindo. But Shubhendu didn't write anything. He didn't communicate anything. So Varinda asked, what did you see? He says, for the first time I saw a complete surrender manifested. Right from the highest heights to the smallest cells of the body. And then he says he knew that the time has come for the divine life to be manifested upon earth. So basically, the body must participate. So one distinction we make between religion and spirituality is religion belongs to the outer surface consciousness. So surface consciousness has also to change. So it has its own meaning and validity. The value of an action derives from the consciousness within. That's exactly what Sri Aurobindo leads us to. So religious approach and a spiritual approach. Now we can come to what really is the difference, because they are two different words. So religious approach is largely confined to the outward. Now we don't know what's happening inside a human being. So we cannot say that just because somebody is bowing down, this is a religious approach. Sometime back, so many such stories I have with regard to people used to carry flowers to the mother. So it's one of those. And in those giving of flowers and exchange of flowers, they were exchanging a whole world. The story of that girl or a lady who took the flower, and the flower was a bit shriveled. So she had a mind to change it. And then she said, well, that's how I am, so let me carry it. And she gave to the mother. She said, mother, I couldn't get some nice flower, and I'm sorry, this is the only thing I could get. So mother held in her hand, she gently stroked the flowers, caressed the flower. The flower began to bloom. And then she says, don't worry, whatever you are, you give me that. So even these smallest gestures, but where is religion? Religion is when you are satisfied with the gesture for the sake of the gesture. There is no deeper spirit. It is the spirit that makes a thing spiritual, if one wants to put it. The spirit that makes a thing spiritual. We may do, as mother says, that one may do exercises like Hatha Yoga, Raja Yoga, Pranayam, meditation, and may have nothing spiritual about it. These are conversation, volume 3. So the disciple gets very, mother, doesn't it give a discipline? He says a discipline is not what we are seeking. Yes, there are so many ways of doing a discipline. But we are seeking something else. It's a living communion with the divine. So religion is an effort at that communion, but it stops short. Where does it stop short? It stops short at the collective convention. So what happens in a religion is that one spares oneself the effort of seeking, the effort of finding, the effort and the joy of discovery. And one leaves it to, it has been thus said someone, and these are the rules, if I follow them, I'll be. So, and then one tweaks around this dogma or a doctrine to justify everything. Sometime back, I remember someone shared this experience that the person asked this other friend that, well, you say that God has just made laws and you have to follow them strictly. And if you cannot follow, you'll be punished. So, what do you think about love? Very valid question. And the person who believed in the law of his religion says, but what? Who said God is love? Now, this is a very strange answer. Who said God is love? Your mind is saying God is love. This is exactly how death says. He says love is an emotion. You have to follow a rule. Rule is given by God. And you have to follow the rule. If you don't follow the rule, you are damned. If you follow the rule, let me put it like that. If you follow the rule, you are damned on earth. If you don't follow the rule, you are damned in heaven. Because it's not easy to follow those rules. You know, if you have to see the clock and suddenly you are in a dreamliner or wherever and suddenly you sit on the carpet. It's so difficult to follow all these rules. I doubt if anybody really in the world follows them to the letter all the time. But there are rules. You try to bypass them. So if you follow the rules, you are damned on earth. Your earthly life is going to take a hit. And if you don't follow, you are damned there. So either ways. So there are, but many people find it very easier. So mother says that many people want to spare the effort of thinking, of reflecting, of trying to find. They find it very easy to belong to a convention. And that's how many religions have their adherents. And they win their adherents. One is by conventions, because you are born in a family and the more the merrier. Somehow we have this idea that the more is better. The more is wiser. A lot of democracy is based on that, incidentally. The more the number, the truer a thing may be. Well, we all know that it may not be. The sun is alone and the stars are plenty. But life on earth depends on that one lonely sun. It doesn't depend on all the stars. Stars are okay. Mariners use it for guidance. Now they don't do that also. But it depends on the sun for everything. The moon has its romantic value. Nice, charming. But the sun, you can't imagine life. So it's not about the number, but religions take comfort in the adherents, number of followers. And often we'll see the struggle going on. Even today somebody sent me some, you know, always this WhatsApp, which is the maximum adherents of religion in the world. So I said, don't listen to all this. Who is an adherent? Followers, we use these words so casually. So we are trying to fool God, but basically that's one reason why religions are there. And then how are the adherents won? So the mother speaks of that also. How do you win the adherents? He says you follow, take any religion where you have number of adherents. It starts with certain stories of miracles at this apex. Now you have certain miracle stories. So everybody begins to connect, because I want to lead my life the way I am, but I want a genie in the bottle. So God is our genie in the bottle. So he will fulfill all my wishes. He will make me suddenly, you know, he makes the deaf hear. He makes the lame walk. They are all beautiful things of the inner life. It's not like, you know, and there is some truth in that. There is a truth in that. So mother says that the problem with that kind of approach is it starts very nicely but ends very badly. Because most of these miracles are because of certain vital forces which they catch. There are strange names for this, you know, people who will predict what is going to happen. Now people get very impressed that, oh, so Babaji knows everything that is going on in my mind. But actually, if you go to the Indian system, this is known as a very low kind of knowledge. It's known as Karna Pishachini Vidya. Imagine, this is a very low vital being which informs you. I know people who you would say, ask me any sweet from anywhere in the world. And you tell and the person will get it within moments. The person who has witnessed this miracle told me this, that, well, he could get it. I said, you want only sweets? Okay, fine. So they have these miracles at the apex, and then they perpetuate through miracles, mass healings, all that. So that kind of religion certainly has to be complete. I mean, it has its place for people who are, you know, totally living in that kind of consciousness. But we must understand that this is not the beginning of spiritual life. Then there is a religion which is all about outer rituals. So in Vedic time, this problem was clarified. It's so interesting when we go back to the Vedic roots. So Vedas speak of the Karma Kanda and the Jnana Kanda. Jnana Kanda. So Karma Kanda is where you have the all these outer rituals, and some time back, even about Auroville, some, again, respected person was saying that how nice if we can have that, bring that Vedic rishi's culture. I said, what do you mean? Lighting fire and then doing the Homa and Yajna in it. It's very nice. I say, whole of Auroville is a Yajna Vedi, don't you see it? People are burning, getting purified. They are the offering. Exactly, I feel that in the ashram. It's a Yajna Vedi. You like it or not, you enter Auroville, you are offered in that Yajna. You may not like it. And you are in it. And then a long process of purification goes on. So that's the inner yajna, and that's what we see even in the Vedic time. You have these two interpretations. One is the Karma Kanda. It is again meant for certain ritualistically pleasing certain gods, deities who will grant a certain benefits. So you want money, so you have a god of money. Now it's very interesting, god of money, it reminds me. It's like you have god of money, Dhan Kuber. It's not Lakshmi, by the way. It's a very wrong conception. God of money is not Lakshmi. Lakshmi is the goddess of beauty and harmony. But god of money, he's a vital being. His name is Kuber. He's a guy who is neither this, all the celestial mid-worlds beings, they don't belong to good or bad. So you'll see them, they can turn either ways. So Kuber is a brother of Ravan, means a cousin brother. So they are all beings who can be this way, that way. He is the god of wealth. Shobindo has written that prayer, no, I am the god of wealth. And he says that all the money is at my... So Kuber is the god of wealth. And so now, see how people change a word, but don't change the understanding. So that's why we have to understand religion and ideology stand at the same level. We throw away the religion, but we hold on to ideology, because they both create the same problem. So what is ideology? Ideology is, I may not worship any god or god of wealth, but I worship money and the god of money. I don't use the word god. This word phrase used by the mother and even Sri Aurobindo says they are actually worshipping the god of money, the god of power who can grant them their fulfillment of their ambition. So it is a kind of approach through which we connect with, there is only one reality to connect, but we connect through one or the other forms, and mainly to fulfill or satisfy our lower nature and its longings. And where we have that, there we have the religious approach. We may do it with outer rituals, without outer rituals. That's a different thing altogether. And the other in the Vedas, we have the Jnana Kand. Jnana Kand is the Upanishads. And Upanishads are where we seek the divine for the knowledge of the divine, for adoration of the divine, for love of the divine. So this is why this is important, is because religion is connected with the heart, philosophy is connected with the mind. Both are inferior approaches, spirituality fuses them. But many times people have this idea that religion means bhakti, surrender, all these things should be out. So when it is said that you have to, there's no religion here. So bhakti, no bhakti, and you'll be surprised. Actually, it seems very foolish to somebody who is a little bit aware of their writings. But many people carry this idea in the head. That not to be religious means not to have bhakti. Whereas if you read Sri Aurobindo, the other day we were reading, bhakti is the crowning movement of yoga. Bhakti is a complete self-giving. Mother's entire prayers and meditations are all about giving oneself to the divine. So there are many kind of understandings or misunderstandings we carry in the head with regard to just the term religious. The other problem, now all this is okay, external rituals, seeking lower things, the higher aspects of the Vedic lore, and that's why we find in one Upanishad and the Gita very interesting statements. In one of the Upanishads, I forget, probably it's Prashna Upanishad, but I may be mistaken. So the Rishi says that, you know, the three Vedas, Athar Veda has obviously not yet come into existence, Rig, Ved, and Rig, Yajur, and Sam, their subject is belongs to the lower. And you have to go beyond the Vedas. Now, Sri Krishna also says, he says, somebody who has found God, for him the importance of the Veda, uses the word Vedavadins. Important of the Vedas is just like a person who is surrounded by water in the ocean has the importance of carrying a bottle of the same water in his hand. So what are they trying to say? One is that go beyond all, the scriptures are an aid. But the moment we begin to walk with the pilgrim staff of faith towards the light which the scriptures are trying to reflect, then spirituality begins. So religion remains at the belief system. I have not explored, because, and we accept beliefs which are very convenient. Like in India, you have this karmic theory which is so strict. My God, if you have lost 100 rupees, means you have probably somebody, or you are pickpocketed. That means you owed him this much money and he has taken. So whenever somebody told me this, I used to argue. I, young boy, no, argue. I used to say, how do you know that now this is not the original fellow doing and next life he has to give me 100 rupees? The second question I used to have is it with interest or without interest? I mean, that 100 rupees in previous life and 100 rupees in this life are going to be phenomenally different. So justice has not been done. And the third used to be this dual system of punishment and reward. I'm just giving one example of certain religious concepts. What is the dual system? You are punished in hell or heaven. Okay, fine, fair enough. You're wherever you are roasted. And such horror shows. Somebody who must be, you know, filled in the mind with some concept of horror devised this. And then you get a birth where it's bad. So what is this double system of reward and punishment? Nobody does that. So, but people accept these concepts. Why? Because they want to spare themselves the effort of thought. One of the things Aurobindo spoke even about, India, says, you know, one of the problems that is there is that we have thought phobia. We don't want to think. And he says, our ancestors swam in seas of thought. This is in his Bengali writings, letter to Barin. He says, we just accept beliefs and we just adopt it. It is so strange and surprising. It's nothing to do with external literacy or education. There are people who just accept it because they are still at the level of the social conventional stage and they just accept any mass kind of thing and they don't want to explore, discover. And so here again we have to understand that there are dogmas of religion, doctrines, and the adherents are supposed to accept them in toto. You cannot, you will not be accepted as part of that religion if you are a non-believer. Now, fortunately, this tendency has escaped in the Indian subcontinent because Sanatan Dharma grew through questioning. If you look at it, this is important because very often when you use the word religion, there is a context in which the mother and Aurobindo are using. And the mother herself clarifies it. Because when we read Aurobindo, we don't find this. You read Foundations of Indian Culture, he speaks about Indian religion and all the beautiful things. But the mother says going beyond religion. So the mother says something very interesting that when she came to India, she says, I had one big problem with the God of religions and I stopped believing because I had no belief in such a God because he seemed to me like a monster. And it is so true. A God who is punishing you, throwing you out because you disobeyed one small little thing. Has to be, I mean, even human parents are better. Even the judge gives a consideration. So God can't be so inferior. And you have these monstrous images of gods which have been created. So she says that I didn't believe. I believed if ever there was a God like that, he must be a monster. But then she says something very interesting. She says, when I met Aurobindo, Aurobindo said, yes, he too had to struggle against it. Because he had an early education in England and so the conceptions were there, which were so much in his head. But when he says how they got clarified, he says when you read the Isha Upanishad and other, you understand that no, that's not the God. So the word God and so many meanings we put into it. So there is a God above in cloud nine, that's a religion. But when we say God is within, God is above, God is around, God is in everything, God is everywhere, that becomes spiritual. God is in each atom of existence. So the larger and vaster and all comprehensive the conception of the divine, the more we are moving towards the spiritual truth. And the narrower and smaller the conception of the divine, the more we are getting entrenched into religion. And especially as I said with these fixed dogmas and doctrines, that's one of the beautiful things about the ashram. There is no, not even a dress code. I mean, a horrible also. How you are particularly walking, it's understood that you have to be decently dressed, but that's social propriety. It's nothing to do with, basic things. It's nothing to do with the code. So the lesser the codes, the better it is, because you can really liberate the spirit from within. You are not worried about what dress I am wearing, but about what is your inner state. So we don't have name changing. Swamiji, the moment you join the ashram, you don't become Swami Alokananda or some Ananda. I just don't know. Why do people carry these kind of names? So, and people call them, invite them for talks. So I said, please, at least get rid of this hypocrisy. And I met someone who was a guru in his own right and who used to come for Savitri classes. Now he's no more. He has even come to Savitri Bhavan for one of those closing lectures. So I asked him that you regard Sri Aurobindo as the highest. He said, yes, without a doubt. Now I know he is the ultimate. So I asked him, why do you continue wearing this soccer robe? He said, you touched me at my weak spot. He said, I would like to get rid of this. I know what it means. But my disciples will, not only abandon me, they would. I said, let them abandon you. So he said, I know, but it's very difficult at this age. He was obviously 75 when I asked him this question. So this externalities, again, for their own sake. But all this is still okay. Where religion becomes dangerous, and that the mother points out, and she puts ideologies at the same footing with religions where they become really dangerous. And where she says no religion particularly is where we have exclusivity. So exclusivity of religion, that, well, my religion is the greatest is bad enough. My religion is the only religion is worse. And my religion is the only religion and nobody has a right to exist is worst. It is fascism, Nazism, if you want to call it. I mean, you may not use the word Nazi, but it's exactly the same, that you are intolerant towards any other approach. So as I was saying, in Sanatana Dharma, it sprung up with questions. There are Upanishads where there is question and answer. The Gita, which is regarded as the greatest scripture, it's all question answers. Where even Arjun doubts Sri Krishna. Not doubt for the doubting sake. That's a different kind of doubt. There is a doubt of the skeptic, which doubt for the sake of doubting. There are also motivated doubts. But doubt here is that I want to know, I want to understand better. So we see that we have to understand that Sanatana Dharma, religion and spirituality existed conterminously. We had the Karma Kand and the Gyan Kand, and both were there, and always the difference was known. So exclusivity of a religion, and Mother and Shubindo speaks about it very clearly, one should be very careful not to turn this seeking into a religion. So what does it mean? It doesn't mean that, well, I'll do anything I like wherever I go. I'll meet 10 gurus. That can be an approach. Well, Dattatreya has done it. But Dattatreya's goal was very different. But here, because there is a special work to be done, there is something known as faithfulness or to the path. And that Sri Aurobindo and the mother categorically say. And very beautifully, even it was asked to Sri Aurobindo, why is the surrender to the guru regarded as the surrender of surrenders? That's why it is said that Guru Brahma, Guru Vishnu, Guru Devo Maheshwara, Guru Sakshat Parabrahma, Tasmai Shri Guru Vinama. So it is said that, and it was asked Sri Aurobindo, he said, yes, it is considered as the surrender of surrender, because here not only your inner being, but even your outer being surrenders completely. Because Guru has a physical personality. So there is, after all, pranam was there, darshan day was there. Are they religious activities or are they spiritual activities? Because your outer being is participating in that. So one had to be, and Sri Aurobindo categorically speaks. Even somebody asked Sri Aurobindo that there is a follower of yours who says this or professes this particular doctrine. So he says, if he does that, then whose follower is he? Follower literally means you are following. There is a path which is given to us. And for this is the path which has been shown by Sri Aurobindo and the mother, the sunlit path. Where does sectarianism come in? Sectarianism comes in if I tell others that this is the only path. In fact, it's dangerous. And both mother and Sri Aurobindo were against this. And for the simple reason, all are not ready. And all are not meant. There are different ways, different goals people have. Even when they go to the divine, this is another question that people ask, that, you know, why, what is sectarian? How does sectarianism come into existence? Because divine is infinite. And you go through any path, you will have an aspect of the divine based on your approach. If I start with an a priori assumption that the divine is impersonal, I'll have contact with the impersonal and I'll say he is Nirgun Brahma. But if I go with this idea that the divine is not only, okay, we start with personal, he is very personal, he can connect with me in a very personal way, then I have the personal aspect of the divine. If I start with this, the divine is not only a being, but a personality, a divine personality, Purushottama Anant Gun, as we know in the Gita, then my whole personality will be consumed by the divine. That's what is called in the Gita as Samagramma, to know him in all the principles and all the parts. So, not all are ready or meant for that kind of vastness. Shobindo says, very few can start with this widest possible idea of the divine. This is a very interesting conversation of the mother. First conversation in 1956, and it's based on a passage from Synthesis of Yoga, that if we have to follow the integral yoga, we must start with the integral idea of the divine. So she asks, what is the integral idea of the divine? She says, we start with an idea of the divine. Divine is this. Then slowly it becomes vaster and vaster, till a time comes when it's difficult even to say what is divine and what is undivine. We see this is the last reconciliation in the life divine. But she says, for action you will need to have some kind of, you can't say all is God and start acting indiscriminately. For action there is a narrowing, there is a focusing, there is a channeling. But otherwise, the widest possible conception. Widest possible is divine is everywhere in everything and in everyone. In everywhere, Shubhindu starts with that. So the idea of an exclusive religion or an exclusive club or an elitist club, that, you know, ashram is an elitist club member who are got a special ticket. All this we have to discard, because then we become part of a collective ego, that we are superior just because we belong to a group. Also, we begin to invalidate others. They have their own seeking. They have a right to follow that, whatever way divine has called them. And we are nobody to disturb their faith. That's how the Gita puts it. We were reading the other day that we are not here to disturb anybody's faith. We are not here to convert anyone, because conversion outwardly has no meaning. So all this idea of religious conversion betrays an ignorance. But we are here to grow in the path that has been shown to us. Their fidelity is important. So that's where, as I was saying, there is a beautiful article of Nalini Dhawan, sectarianism and fidelity to the path. So we have to be faithful to the path that is shown to us. But at the same time, if we say this is the only path that all must follow, otherwise, next step is they are damned. And then the next step is that not only they are damned, they are the problem creator, they have no right to exist upon earth. And then the next step is, it is our holy task that we should finish these problem creators in the world. And then the next step is, we know that fanaticism and fundamentalism has been born out of that. It's very interesting how when we read some of these stories in the Puranas, we discover some very interesting things. So there is a very little episode in Surya Puran. So in Surya Puran, the gurus of Daityas is Shukracharya. So he wakes up the Daityas, Asuras, who are sleeping in Patal, which is subconscious region. And so Narada is very perturbed. He goes and tells Suryadev, what is he doing? Why don't you stop him? He says, no. They also have a destiny. Someday they have to wake up. They are there as part of creation. They have to wake up. So it's all dedicated to Surya, the creator. So then they wake up, and naturally they start coming to earth. They begin to torment, begin to bring all kinds of, you know, their culture, which is hardly anything. And then slowly then the gods and the demons fight, and then the story remains there. But this time the mother has undertaken the next level of work, which is to transform even the demonic aspects in human nature. So very often this exclusivity creates a problem, because again it divides life into the favored ones and those who have been abandoned by God. And there is a very beautiful line in Savitri, I'm sure we are all aware, in book 10, the last bit, canto. Where Canto 2, where Savitri reveals to death that even the dark deities, the darker gods who sprang in revolt, They too are safe. A mother's arms spread wide, wants to bring back, exact line I'm forgetting, desires her rebel sons. So she says that what the white gods missed, because they, there is the black, dark gods who leaped in revolt, and the white gods missed something. And mother's arms are spread even to take them. So this is a very vast movement, this yoga. So you can't limit it here or there or make it like, sometimes we become very exclusive that this person has to be, thrown out. This in Sri Aurobindo ashram, you look at it, that when you see the history, actually Sri Aurobindo never sent away anyone. But there are people who went away. There is a difference. And there is a very interesting communication between Sri Aurobindo and Niruddha. So Sri Aurobindo says, Niruddha says, why did the person go away? Was he sent away? He says, no, we never sent him away. And he was a big problem creator. We never sent him away. So then he says, well, so the Niruddha says, he said that he himself had all this on his head dancing about, and he went away. So Niruddha says, but the grace is there, isn't it? He says, yes, the grace is there. But what if somebody doesn't open to the grace? And so again he says, but still, will the grace abandon him? He says, no, grace never abandons. So if you really look at closely the history of the ashram, they are very rare, and it was when somebody got deranged, and because staying here was more risky. You will see generally that if there were only two conditions, either if the person's presence was completely disrupting the whole atmosphere, this was one. There also they have not sent away, but people have gone. And the second was that when there was this person under the pressure of the yoga was not able to contain it and lost his head. So there were two conditions in which, and then too the compassion followed. There is a story of, it was not done as a kind of cut off. It was done as a kind of with lot of love and compassion. The classic stories of Tirupati. I don't know whether some of us have heard the story of Tirupati. So Tirupati was meant to, he was supposed to represent one of the four pillars of the new creation. So there is four pillars of immortality, which we find in Champaklalji's books. Champaklalji is one of them. He represents aspiration. So like that. And he was supposed to represent, I think, faith. Either Dr. Rajangam or Tirupati. I think Tirupati was faith. But he lost his head, frankly. And Sri Aurobindo, at that time, the intense sadhana, he said, it's better if he stays in his hometown. So he would suddenly get these urges, write telegram to Sri Aurobindo that I am getting messages from inside that I must come. And Sri Aurobindo said, no, 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 don't come. I am myself telling you don't come. And he would write back that, no, no, you are testing me. Inside you are telling me to come, but outside you are trying. So this is very interesting. But when you hear a story, 15 years he lived outside and then left his body. Sri Aurobindo had instructed his brother to ensure that he is looked after. And every which way he was looked after, even though he left. There are a couple of instances like that where Chinmayi was another who had lost her head. Chinmayi was the name given by the mother. She was Dara's sister. And she had lost her head, and she would get hostile impulses to even throw the mother from the staircase. Why I'm saying this is that the understanding of this spiritual path is so wide. So she would get impulses to throw the mother from the staircase, push her. And the mother knew about all this, and she would not say anything. And the disciple says, why don't you throw her, send her away? Mother says, where will she go? If she goes out, she will create more havoc. And then once the mother gave her a little, and this is a very beautiful story. Mother is mother, modes, Mahakali's. So one day she gives her a nice little slap to cure that fellow, forced to run away. So she describes that Sri Aurobindo looked at me and he just said very simply, gently, you ought not have done that. That's why he said he was so gentlemanly. so full of compassion. She speaks of that. You ought not have done that. Even to the fakir who is throwing stones. So we need to understand what a compassionate. This is again important because one of the things she has warned. She said the Lord of falsehood took the form of Sri Aurobindo, the Asura of falsehood. And he wants to create a new religion. So what is the kind of religion he wants to create? He says that he has managed to take a form. Now look at the mother's response. She saw that he has taken this form. Even Nalinida saw that and he wanted everybody's obeisance. So Nalinida almost was bowing down to him. Then he realized that Sri Aurobindo never asked anybody to touch his feet. And he saw the feet and he recognized the difference. And he stopped. And when the mother saw, she just let him pass. So people asked him, why didn't you, just finish him? Said, you know, after all, he had taken the form of the Lord. That kind of love. So she cautions, and this is very important because in times to come, we may make a religion of Sri Aurobindo. And she says, what will be it? It will be a very cruel religion. And she says it will be based on this idea of, you know, power, because that's what the Asura seeks, power and a very cruel religion. And she says, all must be careful and be aware that this is not what Sri Aurobindo is. He is great and compassionate and benevolent. Three words she uses. That he is great and compassionate and benevolent. So we see how in religions, what is the image of God? Asura has made monstrous God. And then comes this last little aspect, which is very interesting. How the Asura works, little bit we should know, because in religion he works like that. So there are people who I've seen who send me letters from UK or other places, and strangely, though they are brought up in a Sanatana Dharma idea, their conception of God is entirely much the later Christianity. I don't use the word, but the beginnings of Christianity is very pure, and Sri Aurobindo writes that. First 150 years, you see the Christianity in all its purity. And later on, Human Cycle, he speaks of that. So I tell them, where did you get this concept? Has anybody taught you? Say, no. And it is a formation. Now the thrones of religions are occupied by very dark formation. And you will see how Islam and communism, they come together everywhere in the world. They come together. Strange. Staunch believer and total non-believer. It's the same Asura which is taking mankind in two different ways. It's a net. And if you walk into it, one can easily get sucked into it. So that's why many religious places, worship, etc. Mother says that, do you really believe that a God, if you seat a God, he will like all this? You're in, especially breaking coconut and God knows, you know, sometimes I feel, what if, you know, God says, shall I break it on your head? Why are you breaking? I mean, offering a flower is beautiful, provided you do it in a nice, beautiful way. Not like throwing the flower, throwing money. There has to be beauty in that. So religion is supposed to be, you know, all the religious literature that we see in medieval times, they're beautiful poetry, beautiful relation with God. It is one of the approaches that connects us to God, to the heart. But what mankind has made in the shrines, there is a line in Savitri, all the world's shrines they have occupied. Who are they? The dark forces of the dark world. All the world's shrine they have occupied. And if you see that description, and slowly this is also, sometimes I feel that it's perhaps time that people should be aware that this is not Sri Aurobindo's, we sometimes, mother has cautioned that a religion where, you know, people are very harsh and all cruel, this is the word she has used, that, you know, it'll be very cruel, totally inconsiderate about anything. It'll purely be based on power. And she says that be very careful. So they will be effort to turn even Sri Aurobindo's teachings into religion. But she has said, anybody who has read Sri Aurobindo will know that it is not possible to convert his teachings into a religion. And that's where it is important. Now I'm coming to this, our context of religion, Sri Aurobindo's yoga. That it's okay. There are different people who understand it differently and speak about it differently, which is fine. That's how it should be. But if one begins to believe that one person, this X or this Y, is the only one who can speak about Sri Aurobindo or represent Sri Aurobindo, one should know that who can speak about Sri Aurobindo? None except him whom he makes speak. And only that much which he makes speak. So she says that who can understand Sri Aurobindo? He is as vast as the universe and his teaching is infinite. It is very interesting. When I had read it, it had struck me. Sri Aurobindo is vast as the universe. Okay, I understand Visharupam. Been blessed with the vision of Sri Aurobindo like that. But teaching is infinite. How can a teaching be infinite? And then I realized the more you connect, the deeper, deeper, deeper layer until you go to a point where the words melt away and in place of that there is nothing but a living sun throbbing with a heart of love. And so she says that, well, who can understand Sri Aurobindo? He is vast as the universe and his teaching is infinite. The only way to come a little closer to understand him or come a little closer to him is to love him and give yourself unreservedly to his work. That is the way. And that's Mother's saying. But then to each one, Mother and Sri Aurobindo will reveal in their own way. And each one will express in his own way. This is perfectly fine. Problem is when one person feels or one group feels this is the only way that Sri Aurobindo can be understood or expressed, that's where the problem lies and one should be very, very careful. So this is the large context of religion and spirituality. I'm not sure if something has been missed, so please feel free. If there is something missed or some question is there, I'll be happy. Gods. Now that is a different thing. That is not only Mother. Very good question. Thank you for saying. That those who want to worship the gods, the full sentence. So those who want to worship the gods are free to do so. But they must know that it has nothing to do with the supramental yoga. So first of all, she is not saying that if you are worshipping Ganpati, you shouldn't do that. That's your problem. Your path, whichever way you want to, wherever you are. So she is not denying anybody anything. But it's not supramental yoga. That one must understand. So what is she really saying and why? First of all, this is not unique to Sri Aurobindo and the Mother. All spiritual teachings at the end of the day say this. The Gita says this. Those who anyanya deva, chapter 9. The Gita says that those who worship the gods, anyanya deva, that other gods. So, and seek desires, he says, ultimately I am the one who grants it. But they go to a lower heaven and come back from there. That's what the Gita says. And they remain in the cycle of ignorance. So again, the Gita doesn't deny. In fact, Sri Krishna goes on to say, I strengthen their faith in whatever they believe in. But they must know that this is not the supreme Godhead of the Gita to whom they are coming. This is the difference one should know. So that's why some people try to, you know, oh, you are not following Sri Aurobindo, you are doing this. Well, it's understood that, you know, Sri Aurobindo and the Mother are way beyond. But it's their problem, their business. Collectively, yes, that's a different thing. Say, I have had this and I know of 2-3 very interesting instances. If there is a center, or let's say there is Savitri Bhavan, please. So this is dedicated to Mother or a center. You start keeping pictures of all the gods and goddesses. Don't mix the atmosphere. You worship. It's your private approach. Perfectly fine. Champaklalji once went to one of the places. Again, I won't name well-known place. Many people would know. He went. Sri Aurobindo's relics are there and that all the images of these gods, which most of them are vital worlds, you know, 8 hands and 6 hands, they don't belong to the real, you know, that's man's representation of the higher mind. So if you want to show 10 powers, so how do you show? So you show 10 hands. So it's not the image, but that the divine has all the aspects instead of, it's a figurative representation of a reality. I mean, Durga exists, But when you have to represent her in the human mind, you do it like that. And these representations had a meaning. So that's why many of these, just as an aside, invaders came, they destroyed the idols. But they couldn't destroy Sanatana Dharma. Why? Because the idols are not just outside, it is also in the mind. So they tried to, you know, take away every possible symbol, the temples and this thing. So you cannot destroy. Why? Because Sanatana Dharma, at the end of the day, Durga is within, Brahma is within, Vishnu is within. You see the Kundalini? Each of the chakra is dedicated to one of the gods. How are you going to destroy? You can't destroy. So this is one part of it. So when Mother is saying this, see, what she is saying is that, well, this approach, if you want to take, you can take, up to you. But this is not the supramental yoga. So, but very interestingly, at one of the places, she says there are three approaches to the supramental yoga. And one of them, she says, a higher intellectual approach, one part. Second, she says, an occult approach. And there she says, through the gods, etc. Now you see, when you see Huta had all these gods. Sometimes she would, you read her writings, Huta, mother has taught Savitri painting. But with Huta, she also gave some of these, she had brought with her some of these idols. So again, we have to understand that it's not like if somebody feels connected, fine. But in a place, so Champakalalji goes to this place and suddenly started picking up and throwing all these photographs. He's thrown, literally thrown from the meditation room. Picked up. Another place in Hong Kong where I had also been. So Gerard was telling me, of course, you all know. So he was mentioning that he went with Champakalalji just to, you know, take care, anything. So they called him and holy man, saintly man. So they started singing some bhajans with all those, you know, typical bhajan. Champakalalji suddenly got up and started moving out. Not started, he moved out of the door. And before people could realize, he was on the streets of Hong Kong. You can imagine. Gerard ran behind. Maharaj, come back, Maharaj. He won't say. Oh. With great difficulty, managed to bring him back. So, they all asked him, but we were only singing some bhajans. So, Champakalalji asked, to whom? Question he writes, to whom? To God. Not the God I know. After that, they all became quiet. So there is, see, again, many people think that, well, again, we can do all this in the name of God. They can do, again, nobody is here to control or manage anybody. If you can do all kinds of nonsense, at least. But one must understand that the supramental yoga is about opening to the mother. Step one, opening to the mother, more. Step two, opening to the mother, more and more. Step three, opening and giving oneself completely to the mother. Step four, till she completely takes charge of the yoga. This is supramental yoga, very simply. All the rest, many people do, you know, add-ons. So people do that. You can't help it. You want to go. And I give this example. You know you have destination Pondicherry. You can take the straight flight. Or you want to go, let's see, Hyderabad on the way. Let's go and, you know, dabble with Mysore is nearby. Bangalore is also there. If you are destined for Pondicherry, you will end up reaching. So it's up to people. They want to take a complicated path. That's how. The second reason about why she says it, because, and why Sri Krishna also says, what are these gods? They are cosmic managers. And these gods have a place in the cosmic functioning. That's why religions which have completely destroyed God, saying they are pagans, have done a great disservice. Because behind, you know, the sense of sacredness in nature is lost. If you read the Druids and Chaldeans, it's amazing. It's like the Vedas. When I read about the Druids, it's like, you know, they were actually occultists. And Chaldea is like, I connect with everything of Chaldea that this is Vedas. And it antedates the Vedas. Incidentally, the Vedas speak of the forefathers. Maybe in some way they were in connection. Mother speaks about Chaldea. And of course, Kabbalah and all this is there as part of that great tradition. So, these gods are cosmic manager, whether we believe in them or not, they exist. And the beauty of these gods is that they bring a certain amount of sacredness in our relation with things. So there is a god of the spirit, mother would call it nature spirit. So there is a spirit of the sea, and she would say, you know, you pray to the sea, Pa guest house story we know. She didn't say, oh, don't worry, don't have to pray to the sea. She gave a prayer to rain. She gave a prayer to the sun. And when people asked her that, you know, this time we prayed to the rain, but still it rained on 2nd December, he says, yes, yes, rain god had come to me. And he said, why are they every time they stop me? This time I am going to see whether your children really have faith in you or not. And then when they came back after the 2nd December program, she said, I am happy that you people did it with the same enthusiasm. I allowed it to rain. And finally, I was proud of my children. Now, you see, so gods exist. The relation with gods exists. This has to be seen in the total context. Even in the three approaches, one of them, she says, is now cult approach through the gods. And Huta, she gives that, you know, Shiva is the lord of transformation. And so when we try to pick up one text and use it trenchantly, then we are doing the same mistake that religions have done. So you can't do away with the gods. They will exist. But where are the gods? In their origin, they are in the one supreme reality. Their origin is in the supermind, where all these gods fuse harmoniously together in the one reality. From overmind downwards, they become, each god has his own abode, his own functioning. So it becomes, their working becomes sometimes, as they go lower down, even quarrelsome between each other. That's why in Savitri there is a line, the quarrel of the gods. So you want to relate with the gods on this level, or you want to relate with them at the level where they truly belong, which is as the specs of the one supreme. So that's why she is actually upgrading the gods and upgrading our relationship with them. So whenever we think of the delightful aspect of the divine, it is the Krishna, automatically. But we can equally bring Krishna down to, you know, Govardhan Puja and all those things they do, which, I mean, all kinds of fascinating things. So that's not what, you know, but she's actually improving our own relation. And at the same time, we don't need to do that, because gods understand each other in their origin. And when we turn to the mother, all gods are part of her. She is the one who brings out not only the gods, but the Sachidanand himself. So when we look at it, the larger picture, we don't start looking down upon somebody or contradicting, stopping someone. Unless we are taking care of a place, and that place, all kinds of things are stuffed, there we have to be very careful that this place is dedicated to Sri Aurobindo and the mother, their atmosphere. So best is all kinds of bhajans going on. That one should be very careful, because it creates a mixed atmosphere, generates a kind of different sort of energy, because many of these bhajans are all about, you know, a certain kind of relation with the gods, even some of them going towards moksha and nirvana. So don't contradict your own aspiration. We should be very focused and one-pointed. So in that sense, we have to see it in its totality. And also, the gods are the overmind creation so far. So now, when we go up, man himself is a god. He is a brother. And this was the ancient truth. When humans participated in the Devasura Sangram, King Dashrath is one example. Muchkund is another. Number of examples of humans who fought with the gods. So ultimately, man has to reclaim that status, where he is fighting on the side of the gods in the Devasura Sangram. And the leader of the gods is Devasenapati Kartikeya, who is basically at the cosmic level the representation of the psychic. So he is the leader of the gods' army. He is the fireborn. So we have to understand it in the total context, and not just the way religions understand the gods. And okay. Thank you so much. Okay. Bye-bye.